Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the death today of Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez at the age of 58 after a long battle with cancer. Javier Carreras, who is the author of The Dragon of the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, joins us to discuss the regional impact of the leader of the Bolivarian Revolution, Hugo Chavez, whose mentor Fidel Castro credits with saving the Cuban Revolution. Then we look further into the legacy of Hugo Chavez with Jennifer McCoy, the director of the Carter Center's Americas program. She previously directed the Carter Center's project on mediation and monitoring in Venezuela. And we will discuss the emotional and political vacuum left in Venezuela following the death of their larger-than-life leader, whose successors are not likely to fill the void, but nevertheless will carry on with the Bolivarian Revolution. Then finally, we will discuss the AIPAC convention underway in Washington, D.C., where, incredibly, the pro-Israel lobby is seeking to make military aid to Israel exempt from the sequester cuts, even though Israel's economy is in better shape than America's, and its latest military technology, like Iron Dome, partly subsidized by the U.S. taxpayers, is more advanced than ours. MJ Rosenberg, who served as Director of Policy Analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and previously was editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy, joins us. I'm now joined by Javier Carreras, who is a professor of political science at Amherst College and the author of The Dragon of the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. He serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center for Global Development and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His latest book is U.S.-Venezuelan Relations Since the 1990s, Coping with Mid-Level Security Threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Javier Carreras.
Thank you very much.
And the death today of Hugo Chavez at the age of 58 after a long battle with cancer is not a great surprise, although it's been kept as a fairly much a state secret for some time. What are you hearing from Venezuela?
Well, situation in Venezuela is, of course, very tense precisely because so little information was disclosed about Chavez's condition. And so people have felt that not enough information had been provided, and that created an unnecessary crisis. There is a new crisis emerging, which is what is going to be next. The Constitution says that an election has to be called, but no mention of an election has been made yet. So we will keep watching to see what the next steps will be.
Well, under the Constitution, the election has to be held within 30 days, does it not?
There is some room for interpretation. The Constitution says it's not clear, actually. The language is ambiguous. It's not clear whether it says that the election has to be held within 30 days or that the election date has to be set within 30 days.
I see. So, but when you talk about the secrecy surrounding Hugo Chavez's health and the extent to which he spent the last few months of his life in Cuba, does this mean that the Venezuelan people have been caught by surprise by his death?
No. I think most people were not in denial. Most people knew that something very serious was happening and that Chavez wasn't going to be able to come back. Only a few very hopeful folks were thinking that there was a good chance. The news were always very grim ever since Chavez went into his last treatment. The situation is that you have a large number of Venezuelans who want to make sure that the Chavista type of policies prevail. And then you have a very large number of Venezuelans, if we go by the latest election, almost 44% of Venezuelans who absolutely feel that this is the worst possible route you can take. You have an incredibly polarized country. The successor who seems to be the person in charge of the moment, the vice president, Nicolas Maduro, has committed to pursuing the most radical forms of Chavista policies. And this has scared the opposition, but it has also enthralled Chavista supporters. So what you have is an enormous level of polarization. In this moment of uncertainty, Chavista supporters are hoping to make sure that you lock in the course, and the opponents feeling like, well, you know, maybe this might be a time for renegotiation, for conciliation, for sitting down, talking to the opposition, consider alternative views. And everybody has high hopes at the moment.
So given the results of the recent election, which Hugo Chavez won fairly soundly, it's unlikely, is it, that the opponent, Capriles, obviously did not succeed in the last election, will do much better even with Chavismo without Chavez, surely. I mean, isn't there going to be an enormous sympathy vote?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. However, Maduro, who is going to run for the ruling party, is not Chavez, doesn't have the level of charisma, so he's going to lose some votes there. And secondly, Maduro is going to lose some votes because the economic situation has taken a turn for the worse in the last 3 months. In October, Venezuela was experiencing yet another consumer boom. The government was spending significantly. They were hiding the fact that the deficit was getting out of hand. Over the last 2-3 months, the government has had to devalue, it has had to cut spending, and Venezuela is plunging into an economic recession. So the longer that they wait to call for an election, the more that Venezuelans are going to feel economic hardships. Also, the government will need to make more polemical decisions. It's not going to be governing in times of boom times, but in times of austerity. So you're absolutely right. The tide is on the side of the government, but the leader is not Chavez, and the economic context is not as favorable as it was in October. So the victory for the ruling party is not automatic, although it seems like if the election were held today, it could look good for the ruling party.
Again, I'm speaking with Javier Corrales, who's a professor of political science at Amherst College and the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. He serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center for Global Development and the American Academy for Arts and Sciences. His latest book is U.S.-Venezuelan Relations Since 1990s, Coping with Mid-Level Security Threats. So the devaluation, the recent one, was about 46%, wasn't it, or something fairly substantial?
Technically about 31%, which is pretty significant,
right.
Though most economists were saying not significant enough to really correct the problem that the government is facing, which is an enormous, gigantic fiscal deficit of almost 16% of GDP. To give you a comparison here, you know, in peripheral Europe, say for example in Greece, Spain, Portugal, the countries that are in worse shape, they have a deficit of about 7-8% of GDP. Venezuela has a deficit of 16% of GDP. And the devaluation will help a little bit, but not enough to fix this problem.
And is given that there are a group of Venezuelan students who chained themselves to the Cuban embassy recently in protest to the secrecy surrounding the health of Hugo Chavez and the what they consider to be the overwhelming influence that Cuba has over the Chavez government, that leads me to question the extent to which inside of Venezuela, the oil subsidies for Cuba and for Venezuela, for Nicaragua as well, are they likely to lose popularity if indeed they are contributing to the economic situation? In other words, when you're feeling the pinch at home, you can't be quite so generous abroad.
Yes, I think as the government confronts the economic adjustments that they're going to face in 2013, the question of Venezuela's generous foreign aid is definitely going to be discussed. I don't think, however, that a Chavista government will cut spending to Cuba or Nicaragua. And the reason is that the amount that is provided to those two countries and to small Caribbean nations is significant, but not significant enough to really alleviate any of Venezuela's economic problems. So it will be symbolically too important in terms of what it will signal. These are important allies of Venezuela without necessarily fixing Venezuela's economic problems. So the government is going to say, you know, it's not worth the pain, so let's not touch that. They're going to have to adjust through other means. I personally don't think that under Chavista government, you're going to see changes in Venezuela's foreign policy to Venezuela and Nicaragua. I also don't think that the opposition, if it were to win an election and come to power in Venezuela, that they will move too drastically in that direction for the very same reasons. These are not going to generate sufficient savings to make that much of a change.
Well, of course, it has made an enormous difference to Cuba. I mean, Fidel Castro himself has credited Hugo Chavez with saving the Cuban Revolution.
You're absolutely right. The Cuban Revolution survived during between 1960 and 1989 as a result of enormous subsidies from the Soviet Union. And one could very well say that Venezuela replaced the Soviet Union and perhaps provides a much larger economic subsidy than the Soviet Union ever provided. Venezuela provides Cuba with not just surplus oil, so that Venezuela has extra oil that it can sell abroad for hard currency, but it also pays Cuba hard currency for the technical and military assistance that Cuba provides Venezuela. And this is a significant subsidy for Cuba. This has been a second miracle to have a major economic patron at this point in the history of the Cuban Revolution. And as I said, I think some analysts would say that the economic subsidy coming from Venezuela surpasses the economic subsidy that the Soviet Union provided, which were quite substantial.
Well, Hugo Chavez himself, as much as he's been vilified around the world, and particularly in the United States, he himself admitted that he came sort of late to adopt socialism, and he told John Lee Anderson of The New Yorker that he read Victor Hugo's epic novel Les Misérables, and of course he was also influenced by his father figure and mentor, Fidel Castro. But my understanding is that he wasn't as virulently anti-American until there was that cabal of right-wing politicians and businessmen and military men in 2002 who conducted a coup against Chavez and detained him briefly until the coup fell apart. And it's pretty clear that the coup plotters got more than a wink and a nod from the Bush administration. I recall at the time Condoleezza Rice, the national security advisor, more or less saying, you know, that we're happy to see him go. And of course, he was only gone for a little while and he was back with a vengeance. And my understanding is that he never really forgave the Americans for that, which is not entirely unjustified, surely.
There is some debate as to when Chavez's anti-Americanism developed. You're right that he didn't start out that way. But interestingly, there are some folks who would say the coup incident that you are describing, which was very delicate in U.S.-Venezuelan relations was not really the beginning of Chavez's most important period of animosity, but it took much later. Right after the coup, Chavez was conciliatory. The United States was invited to become part of a group of international nations called Friends of Venezuela. And so the enormous belligerence took a little longer. It took a little longer. But I am sure that, you know, it could very well have been that Chavez might have discovered, looking back, might have analyzed the events of the coup and said, you know, these guys, the Americans, cannot be trusted. So although there might not be coincidence in timing in terms of when is it that Chavez's anti-Americanism became as radical as it eventually became, you are right that it, I'm sure, plays a role. And the truth of the matter is that once Chavez decides to become very anti-American, he used the coup in every opportunity he had to justify his position. So it served him politically. Whether it was the cost of his anti-Americanism or not, that we will wonder and discuss. But he definitely used it to his advantage and to justify his very belligerence. There's no question that Hugo Chavez has been the most anti-American U.S. president in Latin America since the Castros in Cuba and Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, and certainly the most anti-American U.S. president in Latin America up until today when he just passed away.
Well, I recall, Javier Corrales, when Hugo Chavez addressed the United Nations General Assembly shortly after President George W. Bush had, he made the statement to the effect that he could smell sulfur, that the devil has been here. I mean, that was pretty extraordinary.
That was a pretty extraordinary move, and actually a move that I think he came to regret, because most people thought he crossed the line there, but he became very memorable. Those folks within Venezuela and abroad who were looking to find a very radical anti-American was able to see him there. But it also alienated some other folks who were like interested in challenging the United States, but not as inelegantly as Chavez did it at the United Nations. So it was both a good moment in his effort to become the radical in chief. On the other hand, it also alienated moderate leftists at home and abroad.
Well, Javier Corrales, it seems that in many ways, as a president, as a figure, as a personality, he really broke some interesting ground. Hugo Chavez, he was almost like a reality television star president. You know, he had his television show, Alo Presidente, and he sort of governed like a reality television show. And one of the more extraordinary things he did was once on live on television, he ordered his defense minister to send the Venezuelan armed forces to the Colombian border live on a broadcast of Alo Presidente.
I like the comparison with current reality TV because, as is the case with current reality TV, it has moments of unscripted excitement, but also moments of enormous dullness and predictability. You know, let's remember, he ran his cabinet meetings live on television every Sunday. The shows would go on for hours on end. Many times nothing major would happen. People would be bored to tears. But then suddenly he would surprise folks, even his closest associates, with incredibly unexpected policy decisions, impromptu decisions. So it was this combination of boring routine, prolonged unnecessarily for many hours, and then suddenly a major splash that you couldn't avoid. And the example of deciding we're going to send some troops to Colombia, decided spur of the moment, is a very good example. It was an odd situation. It's interesting to hear reporters discuss covering Chavez because they knew they needed to pay attention to his television show, but they also knew they would also say, who has time? Who has the 4 or 5 hours that are needed to watch a television show where, for the most part, nothing remarkable would happen? But he always kept open the possibility that he might surprise Venezuelans and the world with something that was unpredictable. That is definitely an aspect of the way that he governed Venezuela that we will always remember.
Well, there's no question that Hugo Chavez has tried to meet with President Obama, and he at one point he caught him in a multilateral meeting and gave him a couple of books, I think, by Noam Chomsky and a Latin American writer as well, who seems to have developed a relationship with Jimmy Carter, who's put out a very moving statement on the death of Hugo Chavez, saying how he and Rosalind came to know a man who expressed a vision to bring profound changes to his country to benefit especially those people who had felt neglected and marginalized. Although we have not agreed with him on all his methods followed by his government, we have never doubted Hugo Chavez's commitment to improving the lives of millions of his fellow countrymen. So Jimmy Carter obviously has always played a fairly useful role in trying to urge American presidents to be less rigid in their dealing with the so-called axis of evil, enemy type situations, which the U.S. has got itself trapped in. So what do you think is likely to happen here in terms of a possibility of a thaw in the relationship between the United States and Venezuela?
I think this is a great opportunity. A new government is going to start in Venezuela. We have a new administration with a new Secretary of State in the United States, new Director of the CIA, Department of Defense. So big changes politically. What we need to see is whether the Venezuelan government is interested in improving relations with the United States or not. That's number one. And number two, I think the United States might have lost some interest in improving relations with Venezuela. And the reason is the Americans, in my opinion, are very busy with many other problems. They feel that the Venezuelan oil, which is very important for the United States, continues to come in. Despite the rhetoric of the government, the Venezuelan government remains one of the United States' most important oil suppliers, and the United States can live with that. And so there's a certain complacency that, as bad as the rhetoric is, the economic side of it is okay. Now, Venezuela has two aspects of its foreign policy that the United States is watching very closely. One is proving to be very positive for the Americans, and that is Venezuela is committed to peace talks in Colombia, which the United States is supporting. And on that front, the United States and Venezuela are essentially on the right side, on the same side, excuse me. On the other hand, Venezuela's policy toward the Middle East is at odds with the United States, and especially with Iran and with Syria and with OPEC nations. And so we will have to see what aspect of Venezuela's foreign policy is going to prevail. The aspect that is playing a constructive role in Colombia, which the United States is welcoming, or the Venezuelan policy toward the Middle East, which is very irritating to the United States.
I was going to say, Javier, I'm afraid we've run out of time here.
Yes.
But I do appreciate you joining us, and I thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Good night.
Good night. And again, I've been speaking with Javier Corrales, who's a professor of political science at Amherst College and the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. He serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly, and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center for Global Development and the American Academy for Arts and Sciences. His latest book is U.S.-Venezuelan Relations Since the 1990s, Coping with Mid-Level Security Threats. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with a further discussion of the legacy of Hugo Chavez. Sobrita de reflejo, dame algo tierno, me como tu amor y cago el infierno. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jennifer McCoy, who's the director of the Carter Center's Americas program and a political science professor at Georgia State University. She currently directs the Carter Center's Friends of the Inter-American Democratic Charter Group and previously directed the Carter Center's Project on Mediation and Monitoring in Venezuela from 2002 to 2004. She directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Venezuela, Jamaica, and Peru, and spent time in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Uruguay as a Fulbright Fellow. She has also edited and contributed to several books on the topics of Venezuela's democracy, most recently, The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer McCoy.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
And, of course, today, the Vice President Maduro of Venezuela announced the death of President Hugo Chavez at the age of 58. Not exactly a great surprise, I suppose, given how ill he has been and how many cancer surgeries he's had. But clearly, there's going to be a great deal of grief expressed, I would think, in Venezuela. He was a deeply popular leader.
Yes, that's exactly right. Even though it will not be a large surprise, people had been waiting and hoping, obviously, for the best. And I think it will be traumatic for many Venezuelans. There will be a deep grieving period, a mourning period in Venezuela. They have yet to announce the funeral arrangements, but I think there will be a massive outpouring of grief and before the country can talk about how to move forward.
And just before it was announced that President Hugo Chavez had died, the Vice President Nicolas Maduro had made a number of accusations, and two U.S. officials had been kicked out of the U.S. Embassy, a Air Force attaché and another, I believe, military aide, on the basis that imperialist foes in the United States were in league with domestic enemies. And Maduro went on to say that the allegations that Hugo Chavez had been poisoned by imperialist foes in the United States in the way that Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, who died in 2004, may have been poisoned by Israeli agents. So some fairly strange accusations coming out. Can you sort of dismiss that as just a moment of grief getting the best of the vice president?
I would say so, yes. I think that it is a very emotional time and very difficult for those who had been so close to him, worked closely with him, depended heavily on him. And this, the rhetoric against the United States or against other outsiders and against the opposition, I think it's part of trying to deal with the changes that have to come in Venezuela. I hope that strategy or that direction of rhetoric, of divisive rhetoric and accusatory rhetoric will change now. One of the statements that the vice president did make was that he hopes that there will be peace and love in Venezuela, as President Chavez gave to his people. So I'm hoping that they will take that line now rather than that divisive line.
And in terms of a succession, there it's not entirely clear, is it, under the Constitution, because they sort of punted on the idea of Hugo Chavez having to show up for his inauguration. So the Supreme Court sort of punted on that. So I'm not sure exactly where we stand. Will there be an election, as which I'm...
Yes, because the vice president is not an elected position, it's an appointed position. At any point in the first 4 years of the presidential term, if the president dies, the Constitution says there should be a new election within 30 days. So there should be a new election. There should not be a legal question about that. The only possibility I can see for flexibility with that might be if they argued that they need more than 30 days just to organize an election, but it shouldn't be much longer than that at all.
Well, I imagine then the assumption would be then that the Vice President Maduro, who was handpicked by Hugo Chavez, would be a shoo-in, would he not?
Yes, I think that he will definitely be the candidate on the Chavista side. And then, of course, the opposition would need to name one or more candidates. They've said they want to be unified. They've been having meetings to decide how they would move forward. Given the short time frame, most people are betting that the likely choice would be the former candidate, Enrique Capriles. But, however, they would have to make that decision and make it, very soon after elections are announced, which I believe they have not yet been announced.
Well, Capriles was recently, I believe, in Miami visiting relatives, and that apparently is sort of red meat to the Chavistas. So much of what they say all the time is that the oligarchs that looted the country over the decades before Chavez came in with his Bolivarian Revolution are at work. And my understanding is that Capriles is not a representative of the old oligarchy, but they're doing everything they can to pin that label on him. What's his current movement now?
A lot of that rhetoric, I think, is in preparation for an election. So it's campaign mode rhetoric. Capriles himself is the leader of a relatively new party, started out as young professional parties and young professionals in Venezuela. He has moved more to the left than, I would say, the origins of the party, but he campaigned on a sort of center-left, social-democratic platform last fall, and I expect that would continue the same, a similar campaign this time around. To continue the social missions, that is the welfare programs that Hugo Chavez's government has carried out to great popularity over the last several years. I think, any candidate for president would probably campaign to continue those programs, for example.
So is there any problems with the succession in terms of the military, because there have been some reports that the military have not been entirely happy about the extensive influence that Cuba has had over both domestic and foreign policy of Venezuela. And it has recently, of course, there were a group of students had chained themselves to the Cuban embassy in Caracas in protest to the secrecy surrounding President Chavez's health and the extent to which the Cubans seem to be in charge of his sort of security envelope and all the information about him. And this apparently was galling to some people in Venezuela.
I think that's right. There are certainly different views about the role of Cuba within Venezuela. There is a strong nationalist bent within the military and among others in Venezuela. However, I do expect that the government and Chavistas, all of those who were supporters of President Chavez, will remain united in the near term, certainly through an electoral period, and after, because they all recognize that their interests are mutually intertwined and that they need to stick together to move this country forward through a difficult time. Not only through the grieving, but also, as they have been announcing, there are economic policy changes that they've already begun and that they expect to continue. And I think that they will all view the need for unity, at least in the near term, and that differences of opinion, factionalization is likely to come at some point in the future, but more in the medium term.
And in terms of the broader influence of Hugo Chavez in the region, he, of course, is in many ways a protege of the Castro brothers, and he's made no secret of that. And in fact, Castro himself has said that if it wasn't for Hugo Chavez providing subsidized oil, the Cuban Revolution may have gone under because of the shock of losing the Soviet help when the Soviet Union collapsed. Chavez came in and essentially, at least according to Fidel Castro, in many ways saved the revolution. So the bonds there are very clear. But how is he seen amongst the other left-wing regimes in the region? He's obviously somebody that they've seen as an inspiration, I imagine.
Yes, I think the two countries most dependent financially on Venezuela have been Cuba, first and foremost. Secondly, Nicaragua, which has been receiving close to $500 million a year in various forms of aid and discounted oil. That's been important to the Nicaraguan economy. Others in the Caribbean, for example, have been receiving discounted oil as well. That's been very helpful to them. Other countries in South America have been close friends among the leaders of Bolivia, Ecuador, Argentina. They have all professed their deep friendship with Hugo Chavez, tried to visit him while he was in the hospital. And the government, though they maintain their own identity ideologically, do have some affinities with the Chavez ideas of 21st century socialism. So, yes, I think that they will miss a Chavez as a sort of vocal proponent of change and of independence for Latin America, change in the world system to have a more multipolar system, and for ideas of a more left-wing strategy, say, 21st century socialism to benefit the poor and move forward, as well as some new ideas that he was proposing on the organization of democracy to be more communally oriented and more participatory. Of course, those were some controversial ideas, but those were his ideas for change.
Well, just in closing, Jennifer McCoy, do you see the Bolivarian Revolution continuing without its inspiration?
I do see a lot of support continuing for certainly the person of Hugo Chavez, the legacy of the man, the myth as a man, and I see his movement continuing certainly in Venezuela for some time to come. That doesn't mean that there won't be change in policy, some changes in policy in a new government. I think there will be, but I think his movement and his legacy will certainly live for quite a while.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Jennifer McCoy.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer McCoy, who's the director of the Carter Center's Americas program and a political science professor at Georgia State University. She currently directs the Carter Center's Friends of the Inter-American Democratic Charter Group and previously directed the Carter Center's Project on Mediation and Monitoring in Venezuela from 2002 to 2004. She directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Venezuela, Jamaica, and Peru, and has spent time in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Uruguay as a Fulbright Fellow. And she has also edited and contributed to several books on the topic of Venezuelan democracy, most recently, The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the AIPAC convention underway in Washington, D.C., where incredibly the pro-Israel lobby is seeking to make military aid to Israel exempt from the sequester cuts. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is MJ Rosenberg, who worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years. Previously, he was a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, focusing on foreign policy and the Middle East. And he served as a director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, MJ Rosenberg.
Thank you, Ian.
And all of the AIPAC delegates have descended upon Washington. They've had meetings Monday and again on Tuesday. And what is it that is going on vis-a-vis the sequester? Apparently, in spite of the hit that so many Americans are taking because of the sequester, AIPAC's trying to preserve some of the money that the U.S. gives in terms of military aid. Is that correct?
Until just a few minutes ago, we didn't really know, like, officially from AIPAC that they are going to try to get Israel exempted from the sequester. But Congressional Quarterly just reported, they have a quote from AIPAC saying that the sequestration in general is a bad idea, and it's even a worse idea for Israel to be affected by it. So they intend to fight it. And they even had the article quoted the head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Eliana Ross Lettinen, saying that she is working right now with her colleagues to come out with a way to carve out an exemption.
Well, how is this going to play, though, with the average American when you've got 100,000 kids on Head Start not getting their breakfasts at school, poor families not getting fed? I mean, this is hitting a lot of Americans where it hurts.
Well, traditionally, unfortunately, the American people don't pay attention to this issue. The fact of the matter is that the $3+ billion a year that we give Israel, we give them it without any strings attached, unlike the case with any other country in the world. It's such a unique program, a unique gift to Israel that, despite all our budget problems, it's never argued about, never discussed, no matter what Israel does or doesn't do. I agree with you that this particular thing, where you're going to be taking, you're going to be giving Israel a few hundred million dollars. That's the difference, a few hundred million dollars that will not go to, as I said, kids on Head Start or the National Institutes of Health for cancer research or whatever. That should enrage Americans. It's crazy. Also, Israel doesn't need the money. Israel is one of those countries in the world that has not been affected by the worldwide economic slowdown. So they're in much better shape than we are. And, if the other thing is, if Israel, the way the foreign aid program is set up, if Israel gets exempted, as AIPAC intends it will, the difference in the money will have to be made up by cutting aid to other countries. And those other countries are your traditional foreign aid recipients. They get much less than Israel, but we're talking about particularly sub-Saharan Africa, where it's not arms programs that we provide, where it's you know treatment for diarrhea, pregnancy care, assisting farmers, all those kinds of life and death things will be cut to make up for preserving Israel's piece of the pie. It's outrageous, but I'm not optimistic anymore that Americans ever notice these things.
Well, certainly AIPAC notices it, though, does it not? I mean,
they notice it,
right?
But that doesn't mean. I mean, I saw in this article in the Congressional Quarterly, Congressman Brad Sherman of California, who is an AIPAC stalwart to the nth degree, said flat out, "This will look terrible, and we should think twice about doing this." So I think the only way that they will look twice and not do it is if we give it a lot of attention. This is the kind of thing they like to pull off in the dark. I mean, it's complicated. You know, it's really interesting. Also, J Street, which is supposedly the anti AIPAC lobby, the more progressive lobby on Middle East things, they're also supporting the AIPAC position. They want Israel aid protected. It's outrageous. It's just outrageous.
Again, I'm speaking with MJ Rosenberg, who worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House of Senate. And we're talking about how AIPAC is lobbying to get money that the sequester has cut restored. And, of course, this is in the face of other serious cuts to basic needs for poor children's nutrition, etc., in this country. Now, AIPAC did not take a position on the Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, who, of course, Right. Other groups, other more hawkish pro-Israel groups went after with a vengeance. What's your understanding of why they didn't take a stand on that?
I think they just didn't take a public stand. They decided they're taking a public stand against Hagel, particularly once one of AIPAC's diehard supporters, Chuck Schumer, endorsed him. They realized that Hagel was going to be confirmed, and they decided that they'd be very careful in their opposition. So they didn't oppose him publicly, but all the information that was provided that the senators used, reading out all these things that Hagel supposedly said, resolutions he didn't sign or did sign, whatever. All that information came from AIPAC and its lobbyists. So in other words, they were, they stood behind the scenes and they let these really crazy far-right organizations do the work for them. But there is absolutely no question those organizations if AIPAC wanted to stop that from happening, all they would have had to do is issue a statement saying, we respect the president's right to choose his own Secretary of Defense. They said nothing. So I think it was pretty clear that what they wanted was Hagel to be defeated, but they knew that it couldn't be accomplished. So they tend to be very good about choosing their fights. But if you were a member of AIPAC and called them up and said, I'm meeting with my senator, what should I tell him to do? I wouldn't be in the room, but I'm sure they would have said, well, tell him he should oppose him. He's terrible for Israel. I mean, that's obvious from their point of view, but they're stuck with Hagel now. The anti-Hagel effort accomplished a lot, because I saw today in the paper the very first foreign visitor that Hagel met with was Ehud Barak, and I swear the picture looked like it looked like Hagel was hugging his grandchild. He was so enthusiastic in his love and devotion. I mean, it really had the effect of it's going to really inhibit Hagel, and I think, that's almost as good as stopping him from their point of view.
Well, what I find extraordinary, MJ Rosenberg, is that apparently at the AIPAC convention in Washington, D.C., at the Washington, the Walter E. Washington Convention Center, is the big centerpiece is Iron Dome, this anti-missile system that Israel has developed. With considerable funds from the United States, I might add, $300 million from the Obama administration. And when you say Israel doesn't need the money in terms of this money that goes for military spending or military subsidies for Israel's already incredibly robust arms industry. They're making stuff that's better than what we're making, aren't they? I mean, we have nothing like Iron Dome.
Right. I mean, and they don't need, you know, and they already have Iron Dome, and that, you know, that's a commitment. You know, they, you know, we help them develop it. They've got, you know, and they've got it, and right. They're certainly self-sufficient. I mean, I'm not saying that they don't need any aid from the United States, but, you know, I think what I'm mainly saying is you would think, as a supposed ally, and AIPAC is now lobbying to get that it be designated the highest level of non-NATO ally. As a supposed ally, when they see the United States, when they see Americans sustaining these kind of cuts, you would think if they were any kind of friend at all, they wouldn't dream of allowing their lobby to spare them from a tiny bit of the big pain Americans are experiencing. In fact, I have to say, I wonder if it's Israel that is behind getting the exemption, or it's just AIPAC. I mean, AIPAC has sort of spun out off on its own. It does, you know, people think it always does what Israel wants. It doesn't always do what Israel wants. It certainly didn't support Rabin when he was trying to make peace with Arafat. I mean, this is the kind of thing that AIPAC does because this is their mission. In their own mind, it just seems so self-defeating and stupid for the Prime Minister of Israel not to score points with the Americans by just saying, "Of course, we expect to be cut, just like everyone else." But they don't. They you know, the Republicans always use the word entitlement. Well, the one gigantic entitlement in the budget that no one ever touches is the Israel aid program.
So what is going on in terms of senators, U.S. senators giving AIPAC some kind of commitment that they would stand behind an attack on Iran? Is there anything new to that? I noticed that...
Well, there's Senator Menendez and Lindsey Graham have introduced this, again, this resolution. It's only a resolution, so it's not binding, though. It's worth noting with any resolution, they can easily be converted. Once you go for a non-binding resolution first, and then once you have a Senate, you know, passing it, then you go for a binding one later. So, but anyway, at this point, it's a non-binding resolution that has a whole bunch of whereas clauses, but the bottom line is that if Israel goes to war with Iran, regardless of how it spells it out, regardless of how that happens, regardless of whether Iran attacks Israel or Israel attacks Iran, regardless of how it happens, we are in the war, which is an unbelievable. I don't think there's ever been anything like that. We have that with NATO. An attack on NATO is an attack on the United States. That is how. That's how NATO. You know, that's their. The platform on which it's built,
and that was invoked at 9/11. That's why exactly. the NATO joined in Afghanistan.
Right, but Israel is not part of NATO, obviously, and Israel is a much more volatile part of the world these days than Europe. And this is not a part of the U.S.-Soviet confrontation. This is one country that is refused, you know, absolutely, you know. Has an agenda that, to a large extent, is at variance with our own national interests, and we're saying that if they get themselves involved in a war that they could start, after all, it's them threatening the Iranians all the time. I mean, that is happening. We're just in the war, which is really kind of amazing when you think about the fact that, you know, Franklin Roosevelt could not, you know, had to go through all kinds of machinations to try to get the United States to go in and help Britain in 1940. He couldn't do it. The only way we were able to that he was able to bring the United States into the war to save Britain and France and our allies was, luckily for him, that was a terrible thing to say, Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese, and then the Germans were stupid enough to declare war on the United States. It's serious business. The United States does not just go to war, you know, has never ceded that right to any other country. I mean, that's it's almost crazy. You think about it. Israel, you know, Israel launches an attack. The attack doesn't go well, and the next day, the United States, our bombers take off from aircraft carriers, and we start bombing too. I mean, it's crazy stuff. But you know, Menendez has got big political problems now because of all the, you know, these corruption charges, and Lindsey Graham is trying to raise money from pro-Israel donors for his, he's worrying about a primary from the right in 2014. So this is what they do. This is what they all do, and the reason that they all do it is for campaign funds. I can't stress that enough. But I also want to stress that, and I always want to say this so I'm not misconstrued, AIPAC is not the only lobby that operates that this way. This is our government on every single issue. It's fat cats and fat cat lobbyists overruling the interests of Americans. It's the way it works. AIPAC plays the game really well, and the difference is it's doing it for a foreign country. But hey, that's Washington. That's the city I live in.
But what is particularly galling at this moment, I think, is that when you've got across-the-board cuts resulting in 100,000 fewer low-income children being prepared for school through Head Start, 17 million fewer Meals on Wheels delivered to seniors suffering from food insecurity, and 1.6 million fewer unemployed Americans served through job training, education, and employment services. This is the reality of the sequesters on the American people.
Right.
And I guess the point you're making is that maybe this would be a time for Israel to be magnanimous, given how generous the American people have been over the decades. And, of course, we're talking about military aid to a country that in many ways has a more advanced military industrial complex than ours, given how much celebration is going on at the AIPAC meeting over the successful Iron Dome system, which the Obama administration in part funded.
So, exactly.
I guess those are the questions that at least come to mind with me. So
it's almost like all we're asking of the Israelis is simple decency. You know, America, you know, we've got this damn sequestration thing here. It's the law, whether we like it or not. Americans are going to suffer because of these cuts. Well, you have to take the cut too. It almost seems like axiomatic. That they should just order, it just should be so obvious. In fact, the law makes no exemption for Israel, obviously. So they, you know, the only hope here, and it's a distance hope because of the nature of the people we're dealing with, the Tea Party crowd, the right-wing Republicans don't want any exemptions for anything. They love the sequestration thing. So it'll be really interesting if all these super patriot types, all, you know, who are so happy they have sequestration, then say, oh, let's exempt Israel. But you know what? Anything's possible with the lobby. They're probably on the phone right now with, you know, who's the head of the Tea Party in Congress is Eric Cantor. I'm sure he's quite sympathetic to an exemption for Israel.
Well, MJ Rosenberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you so much, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I'm speaking with M.J. Rosenberg, who worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years. Previously, he was a senior fellow for Media Matters for America, focusing on foreign policy and Middle East and Middle Eastern affairs. He served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of the Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, that's AIPAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was